Chapter 1, Butter Bar. The pair of orbital mirrors cast wintry light on the company's base. The physical fitness facility's walls of woodland camouflage rose above berms capped with sandbags. A curtain wall about 2.5 meters high hid the PT facility's entrance from a casual glance. Tomas approached, boots squeaking on the snow, when a voice came from someone standing behind the curtain wall, out of sight.
"We should let Papa Romeo have this bloody planet."
Tomas stopped, a moment to place the voice. The Scantia man in the scout squad. "Connor? Campbell?" The scout's voice continued.
"It snows every 10th day, and the terrain's uglier than that one daughter of Astarte on Kallenberg.
And the locals all talk like poofs," another scout said.
This one put on an Ardennese accent.
"Forsooth, let Papa have this horse sun planet."
The Scotchian man laughed, and the second scout chuckled at his own joke. A third voice spoke up, belonging to Corporal Nilsson, one of the scout squad's fire team leaders. His voice lacked humor.
"Papa can take the butter bar while he's at it."
The chill air bit the lining of Tomas's nose. He narrowed his eyes and angled his ear toward the front of the PT facility. Nilsson's records portrayed a better soldier than the one Tomas had seen while commanding the scout squad cross-posted to his armored grenadier platoon.
"Lieutenant Neumann's not a bad officer," said the second scout.
Tomas placed the voice. "Gorthy, from Satayuga." He even got the pronunciation right, Neumann.
"For an armored grenadier,"
Campbell said.
"He's not a paper tiger."
"You think academy grads are bad?" Nilsson said. "He's worse."
The others muttered words inaudible with distance. Tomas shuffled closer.
"Hear me out," Nilsson said. "Paper tigers got to the Ground Force Academy on family connections. They saw it as a shrewd career move before the war. But when the war broke out, they wanted to lie low so they can go home to run for election or take over the family business. If they lie low, the better chances we can lie low, especially now that the war's over and we lost." He went on. "Now look at OCS grads. They survive battle and then volunteer for more. They believe the bun comms about truth, justice, and the Confederated World's way. They want us to believe it too, even if it means we all get killed for nothing." Only the faint crackling of cigarettes, a vile habit common among scouts, sounded for a moment. Tomas reached for his collar, glanced down. The chameleon cloth showed a yellow butter bar, signifier of his rank, clean and pressed in yesterday's laundry. He brushed away non-existent dirt from his yellow bar, then put on a stern face and strode around the corner toward the PT facility entrance. Gorthy saw him first. "Tin hut,"
the scout muttered to his peers. He straightened his back and pulled his hand from his pocket. A flick of his other hand sent his cigarette 2 meters against the wall of the building. Campbell dropped his cigarette and pivoted to face Tomas. Under their saluting hands, both scouts showed nervous faces, like boys expecting a scolding. Nilsson leaned against the curtain wall. He eased to an upright position, dropped his cigarette. The cigarette sent up a plume of smoke and steam for a moment before Nilsson ground it into the snow. Although he saluted by the book, his hooded upper lids gave his pale blue eyes an impression of cool regard. Tomas saluted back. His expression matched Nilsson's. "At ease." Campbell and Gorthy relaxed. Nilsson's demeanor showed no change.
"Does your sergeant know you're lounging around?" Tomas asked.
He scowled at each of them in turn.
"We're officially on PT for another 8 minutes, sir," Gorthy said.
His bulbous nose contrasted with the lines of his face, sharpened by training and action.
"The company kinesiologist checked off our worksheet as being intense enough about 10 minutes ago.
What did you bribe her with?
Campbell's eyelids fluttered.
Instead of catching our breath after a set, we start right away into a different lift, sir.
Tomas's scowl hardened. You finished your workout fine, but it sounds like some of you think our brigade's mission here on Arden is for nothing.
Just letting off steam, sir, Campbell said.
There's no steam to let off. It doesn't matter that Shirley Foxtrot couldn't keep the Progressive Republic Space Force from reaching Challenger. It doesn't matter the politicians on Challenger gave away half a dozen solar systems in the peace treaty. The only thing that matters is our superiors ordered us to suppress pro-PR irregular military action before Arden votes to stay in the Confederated Worlds. That means there's another month left in our war. A sports metaphor from one of the OCS instructors came to mind. And we're going to play to the whistle. Do you hear me? He scowled at Campbell and Gorthy. The two scouts nodded and said, Yes, sir. Tomas turned to Nilsson. The scout corporal gave Tomas the same flat stare he'd held throughout the encounter.
As you say, sir.
Nilsson's attitude made it easy for Tomas to remain brusque. I don't know how you ever made corporal. I've seen better men than you die. Memories from his tour as an enlisted man on New Liberty stirred in his subconscious. Gorthy and Campbell looked shocked. Nilsson's expression remained unchanged. Tomas turned up his glower. Listen to me, Nilsson. You've got 32 days in the field until we leave Arden. I will be watching you every one of those days. If you malinger or spread defeatism or commit anything else colorable as an offense under the Code of Military Justice, you'll be staring down a court-martial and facing years in a terraforming battalion before you get home to Midgard. The flat stare buckled for a moment. A plea in the eyes, a petulant quirk of the mouth. Nilsson apparently held from Oosterbotter, and you should know those things about your men. And if Nilsson wanted to be treated with dignity, he should view his superiors with respect. The attitudes Tomas had taken in from his OCS instructors and skills imps clashed with his recollections of being a grunt and serving under officers, good and bad. You aren't officer material, part of him thought for the 100th time. Anxiety squeezed him, inside, where the men couldn't see. What choice do I have now? Tomas inhaled the crisp air and refocused on Nilsson. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir,
Nilsson said. Then his gaze turned to the sky over Tomas's shoulder, and a haggard look formed around his eyes. Tomas turned. Arden's primary, a gas giant named Prospero, covered 5 degrees of the sky near the zenith. It looked like a child's ball held at arm's length, a round bruise in the cloudless blue sky. The weak rays of the system's red dwarf star, Son of York, now turned half of Prospero's visible face into a purple and blue hemisphere, barely brighter than the shaded hemisphere of the gas giant's night. He'd grown up on the gas giant's terraformed moon and seen pictures of the rings of Saturn in far-off Sol system, but Tomas had never seen anything like the aerial band. Formed from zettatons of water and methane ice melted on Arden's surface and expelled at high velocity from the top of the space elevator during the terraforming process, the aerial band ringed Prospero far more densely, widely, and thickly than the rings of Saturn. In the distant future, long after the war had become a footnote in history texts, some of the ice might coalesce into another moon of the gas giant. For now, the trillion-trillion chunks of ice marked Prospero's midsection and glittered in the thin light of Son of York like the diamonds of a wedding ring. As it always did, the sight reminded him of Lissa. I want to get home in one piece, same as all of you, part of him wanted to tell Nilsson and the other scouts. But an officer couldn't show such weakness to his men. especially now, given the unnatural features showing in Arden's sky. Not the two arrays of mirrors, tens of thousands of kilometers across, attending the planet at the gravitationally stable L4 and L5 points formed by Prospero and Arden, gathering and focusing the wan sunlight onto Arden's surface. Instead, descending through the indigo sky under the now edge-on L4 mirror, came six fuzzy glows of light, falling down the sky like lighted marbles in some clear but viscous liquid. Either they descended very slowly, or they aimed for landing points hundreds of kilometers away. Why bother setting the building's chameleon skin to camouflage? The only ships in orbit are the Progressive Republics. They have the coordinates of every structure on base to within a meter, and all the camouflage in the Confederated Worlds won't help us if they support their allies on the ground with orbital fires.
"Ouch, I've never seen Papa land so many in one go," Campbell said.
Papa, from Papa Romeo, the phonetic alphabet letters for the initials of the Progressive Republic. Six ships. Officially, the Progressive Republic denied it ever landed ships on Arden, let alone ships loaded with weapons, materiel, or combat advisors for the pro-PR insurrection active in the wild lands recently seeded with terrestrial life by Arden's ecological engineers. But under the terms of the treaty, Papa's ships held orbit over Arden, and the nearest units of the Confederated World Space Force remained in dock in the Novo Toscano system, two artificial wormholes and 12 light-years away. Six ships and only one overstretched ground force battalion to deny them operational freedom over 1 million square kilometers of the planet. Tomas turned to the three scouts. "You might have 10 minutes more relief before the order comes for us to saddle up. Use them wisely. We'll be cooped up in our rides for a long time."
"Yes, sir," Campbell said.
He and Gorthy shared a look, then went through the gap in the curtain wall toward their bivouac. Their cigarettes remained, brown shades of tobacco and filters littering the slushy snow. Nielsen stood for a moment, fixing a 1,000-yard stare on the distant points of the descending fusion drives. Tomas had seen that look on many a face. You could take the man's body out of combat, but part of his mind would always be there. Nielsen took a breath, shook his head. With crisp, economical motions, taken without regard for Tomas's presence, he squatted near his dropped cigarette and scooped it up with a handful of boot-dented snow. A habit of security, leaving no spoor for a foe to trail him. Nielsen was a diligent soldier. Why was he so surly? Which side of him would come out on their next mission? Amid cheap plastic chairs, next to a table perched on spindly carbon nanotube legs, Captain Bao waited in the conference room of company headquarters. An unrolled display, 1 meter by 1.5 meters, lay on the tabletop, its corners glued down by blobs of reversible adhesive. Captain Bao's chin slumped against his hand while his gaze flicked from spot to spot on the display. Tomas stopped inside the doorway.
"Lieutenant Neumann reporting, sir."
Captain Bao looked up. "Come on in." A step, a glance around. "Where's everyone else?"
"You're early, Neumann."
Captain Bao turned back to the display. "Take a look." Tomas approached the display. Earth tones and mottled greens mapped 1.5 million square kilometers of Arden. In common with most of the territory of most freshly terraformed worlds, this region of Arden held scattered settlements of artisan farmers, ecological engineers, or followers of heretical branches of the local religion. Rumor had it some dabbled in quasi-intelligent computer code and other immoral practices shunned by worlds that remembered the causes of virtual fugue on Heinlein's world and Earth. Thin black lines showed the roads linking the settlements to one another. The company's home base and, via the one broad highway entering the region from the southeast, to Belmont, the planet's capital city. Thinner gray lines marked the wired communication net the ground force relied on during the times Papa Romeo's ships in orbit accidentally jammed radio communications. A bright green line marked off a quarter of an annulus, like the last bites of a giant donut with Belmont in the hole. Inside the quarter annulus lay the company's sector, a vast stretch, 1,000 kilometers from the inner edge to the outer. Impossible to patrol even if the full battalion, or even the entire brigade, devoted itself to the task. The company had help, at least on paper-thin graphical display. Each of the settlements had a powder-blue icon representing a unit of the Arden Volunteer Constabulary. Icon size and a badge in traffic-like colors showed each unit's notional effectiveness. The same powder blue tinged the terrain around the settlements and sent arms down the roads. If the map could be believed, the constabulary patrolled every stretch of road every day, from the rawest privates to the officers on Captain Bow's staff. Few of the company's personnel believed it. They spoke the nickname of the constabulary, Archars, with the contempt all line soldiers felt for the local militias. Tomas held back from that judgment. The constabulary existed to deny the settlements and roads to the pro-PR insurrection and sometimes fix the rebels with observation and fires until the ground force could deliver the knockout blow. That's all they could ask of men with families and careers. Staying home gave no guarantee war would leave you alone. One other color rounded out the map's palette. 6 gold spots marked Papa Romeo's approximate landing sites. 5 of them formed a wavering line, roughly northeast to southwest, about 400 kilometers from the company's base. Tomas looked for landmarks, the towns of Sempronius and Verona to the northeast, the Sycorax Hills, another town, Eltham. The bright green of their sector boundary bisected the wavering line before its final point, near the town called Eastcheap, south of them in Bravo Company's sector. The 6th landing site lay 300 kilometers further to the west of the others. Only a single ecological engineering camp, abandoned since the start of the insurrection, showed anywhere nearby. Footsteps and a conversation flowed into the room. Tomas turned to see the 3 members of Captain Bow's staff, the executive officer, the supply and support officer, and the first sergeant. The conversation dried up. All 3 looked weary. "You look like I feel," Captain Bow said, "but we're going to get through this. 32 days. We can sleep the whole way back to Challenger." He looked past the new arrivals to the entryway. "Lieutenant Landon, Staff Sergeant Cabotin, come in." The last 2, the company's platoon commanders other than Tomas, had little in common. Lieutenant Landon had an academy degree and chiseled cheekbones. On the warm days of Arden's weather, he wore short sleeves that showed lean yet muscular arms. Though commissioned after Tomas, Lieutenant Landon showed only confidence verging into arrogance. Cabotin, in contrast, exuded a Grant's fatalism. His stubble chin, at odds with his soft face, showed an expectation that anything that could go wrong would, at the worst possible time. He commanded a platoon because his superior, Lieutenant Callis, lay in a medical tank in the hospital in Belmont after taking a sniper round through the head. The crowd gathered near the table. Bow cleared his throat. "You all know why we're here. 6 Papa ships came down Jacob's Ladder 30 minutes ago. Lieutenant Neumann is going to tell us his plan for dealing with them." Tomas jerked up. "Sir?" Captain Bow raised an eyebrow. "You've studied the map more than anyone else, haven't you?" Tomas blinked. Words failed him. Bow usually started a conversation and built a consensus from his platoon leaders. Why was he singling Tomas out this time? "Come on, Neumann," added Lieutenant Landon. "OCS intake knows what it's doing, most of the time." The others stayed quiet, but their faces lacked sympathy. Tomas dropped his gaze to the map and breathed deep into his belly. "Landon and I split up these 4 sites." He pointed to the middle of the map. "My platoon will scout the sites near, doesn't matter which, pick 2, Sycorax Hills and Eltham. His will take the other ones near Sempronius and Verona. Cabodin will stay in reserve to give his platoon more time to recover from its recent action. The staff sergeant let out a barely audible breath. Tomas pointed at the distant landing site near the ecological engineering camp. This one is too far, at least until we scout the nearer sites. We tell the constabulary units nearest to this site to do more aggressive patrolling in their immediate regions. If one can spare the men and vehicles to scout the landing site, so much the better. Archers? Asked Lieutenant Landon. They aren't even scouts, for Christ's sake. With Callis in the hospital, only armored grenadiers led the company's combat platoons. Another deep breath held for a two-count. Perhaps I expect too much, Tomas said. He glanced up at the company's SSC officer, a blonde mitt-guarder with soft brown eyes. Lieutenant Harald Statir, can you spare a few fab cycles for a piece of equipment a constabulary unit might want? She squinted. Let me think. Captain Bao spoke. You want to offer the Archers a carrot for reconnoitering that landing site? If Lieutenant Harald Statir says she can spare the fab cycles, then yes. Lieutenant Harald Statir nodded. They're always asking for better trace metal extractors than civilian fabs in their towns are allowed. We can squeeze one into the schedule over the next 4 or 5 days. No, Lieutenant Landon said. Quite the bad idea. Don't you agree, Captain? Captain Bao gave him an impassive look. Give me more info, and maybe I will. Lieutenant Landon's face showed a certainty the captain would come to agree with him. It's a point the Academy instructors hammered into us in counterinsurgency class. We have to assume at least some Archers are rebel agents. If we give the Archers equipment to make better vehicle parts or whatever, there's a chance they'll give it to the rebels. Tomas frowned. With these landings, Papa Romeo might be giving the rebels much more and better materiel than one metal extractor. 6 ships could land 2 companies of tanks. With a nod, Cabodin said, even if the rebels take a metal extractor, they couldn't fab enough stronger alloys in the next month to make a difference. I've heard the pros and cons regarding the site near the ecological engineering camp. Captain Bao appeared at the last spot on the map. What about this one near Eastcheap? We alert the constabulary units on our side of the sector boundary, and after Bravo Company steps on its own, Tomas rarely used salty language, and especially not with a lady present. Tell, whichever of Landon or I finishes our part of the mission first can help it. Captain Bao and the executive officer chuckled. The mood of the others lightened. Even Lieutenant Landon's usual smirk changed to include Tomas within its circle. A sad fact about human nature, that a strong way to build camaraderie among one's team lay in denigrating another. After his chuckle faded, Captain Bao rubbed his chin while his gaze roved over the map. Good plan, Neumann. Sir? Thank you. Captain Bao looked up, taking in Tomas and Landon. Now it's time to execute. I want to see your platoons roll out the gate within an hour.